King, reel number 6. I believe there were a few hazards in flying the British aircraft at this time.
Yes, there were, because we had no distinguishing marks on our aircraft. Now, the Germans hit on a very good plan for marking theirs. They had a big black cross on a white ground, and we had nothing. So our infantry and other soldiers, if there was an aircraft came too low over their trenches, they'd fire at it, whether it was British or German. And so they did a lot of damage that way, and something had to be done about it. And one of our NCOs flying like that, he got wounded by a bullet which came through the seat. And so, as a temporary measure, we put steel plates in the basketwork seat so that wouldn't happen again. And then we tried to decide on some kind of a mark for our own. Well, the first thing was to put a Union Jack on. They painted Union Jacks on the underneath of the plane and flew up with it, and that just looked like a smudge. And then they tried painting a bar across, but that didn't seem much. And we did it in flights. And then we painted the target, as we used to call it, what they call the roundel now. And the aircraft was sent up, and the staff officers decided that was a good thing. That would distinguish ours from the Germans to help the infantry. But while that was going on, we actually sent some men from the Royal Flying Corps into the trenches. And if an aircraft came over, that man would tell the commander of the platoon whether it was German or English before the roundels were painted on. But after that, when the roundels were painted on, there was no more firing at our own machines. And that was about after the first, say, 4 months of the war, I suppose, before they did that.
Could you describe for me what the relations were between the RFC and the other branches of the army at the time, and what your attitudes were towards each other?
Well, I think it was very... Yes, our relationship to each other was very good. I've already said we used to send one man from a time up to a certain area of trenches to help to spot and distinguish the English from the German aircraft. And they were always treated very well by the men. The men in trenches used to be sorry for the men who were up above, with no means of sheltering from bullets and shells, and quite vulnerable, where on our part we were sorry for the infantry floundering about in the mud in their trenches. So there was a mutual respect, and the feeling was very good between us. That's all I found. What it was in higher levels, I don't know, but I never found, in after duty mixing with men of the infantry and so on, I never found any bad feeling whatsoever between them and us.
Could you tell me how the aircraft of number 5 Squadron stood up to the stresses and strains of active service during this time?
Well, these aircraft in peacetime had always been kept in hangars and, as you might say, petted and coddled. The aircraft were kept in a warm hangar, and the rain never rained on them or anything. But on active service, they were out in the open all the time, and their great enemy was the wind. These aircraft used to stand in fields anywhere, sometimes exposed to gales, and we used to just put a block behind them or picket or something, but not any very serious. And one night a very heavy gale came along and tore the aircraft away from their pickets, and one or two were destroyed. And so all the men who were actually working on aircraft were hailed before the commander. And he said something like this. He said, you men must guard these aircraft with your lives. Without these aircraft, the army is blind. We are the eyes of the army. And if it's between you and the aircraft comes first. We've got plenty of men, but we can't get aircraft. Well, after the this gale which damaged these aircraft and the ticking off we had from the commanding officer, we had to take a lot more trouble in picketing them out. One thing, we always had to pit them head to wind, and we got long pickets and great big stakes and drove into the ground, and even then some of the aircraft came adrift, till we got to the point where we had to dig holes in the ground and make a ramp and run the aircraft down into this hole to keep the wind from coming onto the plane. Now, we had Henry Farman aircraft at the time, and they were very light. There was no weight into keeping them heavy. So we dug these pits and run them down into the pits so the wind couldn't get under the plane, and that was all right. But then, unfortunately, when the rain and snow came along, it filled these pits with water, and then the wheels had to be taken off and cleaned, and that was a great trouble. With the keeping them down on the ground and yet keeping the vulnerable parts dry. And it was easier in some aircraft than others, but the Henry Farman was so light it was very vulnerable.
What about the Avros? You had Avros at this time as well. How were they?
Well, the Avros were different, you see. The Avros, if it was well picketed down in front, even if the wind lifted the tail, it wouldn't tend to lift the machine so much. And they, all the tractor machines stood it much better than the pushers, because of their shape. And so our Henry Farmers were very difficult to deal with in a high wind. And many a time we used to have to be all turned out and stand by the machine all night. And didn't matter if it rained or what happened, those machines were more valuable than we were. That was impressed on our mind. So if there was a gale, we not only picketed them down and put them in trenches, but we stood by them. And that's a fact.
Could you tell me what your recollections are of your commanding officer with Number 5 Squadron, Major Higgins?
Well, we liked Major Higgins very much because he was always with the machines, and he was always trying different experiments. And he got a little aircraft from England. It was called a Martinside Scout, a Martin and Handerside was the firm, and he tried very hard to fix a rifle onto that machine so that he could indulge in some kind of aerial combat. And rifles are cut down, the butts taken off and stick in different plates on this aircraft of his with shortened barrels and so on, but it never came to anything. He tried very hard in all ways to have a fixed gun. And on the Henry Farman, the pilot sat in the front seat and the observer the back, and he had a rifle and 50 grounds. And I myself, when I have flown at any time, always took a rifle and 50 rounds. Presumably, if a hostile aircraft came up, you'd fire at it. But as we were as likely enough to fire on it, some part of our own machine, it wasn't encouraged. And as far as I know, the Germans and British flyers didn't go into aerial combat at all at that time. They were too busy doing their reconnaissances or an aerial artillery spotting. And Major Higgins evidently foresaw there would be aerial fighting. And he did his best to try and fix a gun in some way which would be able to enable him in his fast scout to fire at Germans on patrol. But as far as I know, it never came to much. He couldn't do it because of the firing through the propeller. Yes, we were rather fond of Major Higgins, and we felt that he really was a commander who looked after his men. I'll give you an instance. Once I had been on a flight with a Lieutenant Ribagliati, one of our pilots, and he made a very bad landing. He half slid and half landed into the aerodrome and knocked the undercarriage off. And Major Higgins came running across and he said something like, if you want to kill yourself, you can, but don't kill one of my men. I thought that was very good of him.
Are there any other characters in Number 5 Squadron who you particularly remember?
Well, there's our disciplinary sergeant major, Sergeant Major Parker. And he came from the King's Company of the Grenadier Guard, so that might give you some idea how strict a disciplinarian he was. He was very, very strict indeed. He never spoke to a man without criticising him in some way or other about his stance or his equipment or something or other like that. And yet we all liked him very much. And his nickname was Chesty Parker. And whatever the rough condition were, he always looked as clean as a new pin, clean and smart, and he did his best through thick and thin to keep us the same. And we always had an affectionate idea for both Chesty Parker and Major Higgins. They were a very good pair, and we did very well under him under active service conditions.
During these early months and the first months of active service you did, how efficient do you think you were as a unit?
Well, I would say we were very efficient. One of the most important things, as you know, army moves on its summit. Well, we were never short of rations. Somehow or other, we always had some kind of a ration. We were never short of food. We always had tea and at least bully beef and biscuits. We were never hungry. The commissariat was very good. We were never short of ammunition. And bombs, well, they were only like grenades. We had one kind of a bomb which we had in the undercarriage. We hung up in the undercarriage of the Henry Farman, and it was contained 2 gallons of petrol, and in the nose there was a very light cartridge. And if this bomb was dropped, the cartridge used to explode and set fire to the petrol, and that was a primitive fire bomb. And another thing, this is rather interesting, the small grenades they had. They had these grenades and they hung on the nacelle of the aircraft, and the pilot would take them out of the rack and throw them at his object. And they had a plastic cap at the top, and when he was ready to throw them down, he used to undo the cap, put the detonator on, and just take them out of the rack and throw them to the ground. Well, for some reason or other, the tail on these bombs was too short. It, as far as I remember, it was about 1/4 inch iron rod, about 6 inches long, and it was too short. So they wanted to extend this to, we'll say, 12 inches. And they took these bombs, and without detonators in, and they gave them to the smith, and he had his little portable forge, and he actually welded a piece of metal onto the live bomb. He was careful to keep it cool all the while with water. And when that job was on, we gave him a very light, wide berth. And he would say, well, what are you chaps walking right over there for? What's the matter? And he merrily, for perhaps a day, did a pile of these bombs, welding a little piece of metal onto the live bomb so that it was better to hang on the side of the machine. And that was quite a thing. People would hardly believe it, but he did.
Now, at the end of the 6 months in France, when you returned to England, what do you remember of the general atmosphere of the times and the reactions of people to you?
Oh, as soon as I got out of the train in London and walked along the street, people came up to me and said, "What is it like in France?" Everyone seemed to be doubtful of what was happening over there, and to see me, they could see in my dirty uniform, I'd come straight from the front line, as it were, and everyone was anxious to know what really happened. And everyone was very friendly, but they seemed to be lacking in information of what was actually going on there. And I was questioned from all sides about what was happening, if I thought we were really winning, and what the position was. And wherever I went, that was the thing. But everyone I spoke to seemed to think the war would be over very soon. They never visualized a long war. They thought either the Germans would win it quickly or we would win it quickly. And everyone was most friendly and asked me for every information I could give them about the position in France. They didn't believe what they'd been told, and everybody wanted to know firsthand what had happened. And everyone was treated as a hero who came back at all. Everyone who just could see, like they could see for me, they'd come from the front line, was expected to know all about the war, where we only knew just a little bit where we were. But everyone, I think, was more or less confident we would win, but above all, they thought this war would very soon be over. That was the main point about it. I don't see any more than that.
Were they very keen to buy you a drink or anything like that?
Oh, yes. And whereas the soldier was looked down in peacetime, he looked down on, and then tolerated at other times. At times like that, he was heroic. Nobody could do enough for him. He was offered drinks, he was offered everything. He was absolutely wonderful at that time because it was a new thing, some soldier returning from the war. There hadn't been anything like that since the South African War. So, of course, I bask in all the glory of a returned hero for the time being.